I supposed to give a review for the mirror of physics for the Cohn-Mentor boundary issue. I'm not sure I can give you really thorough review for this really very extensive field. And I'm going to focus on just a few topics, including the recent interesting discovery in mirror of physics for the post-perovskite phase. I used to work on post-Spinel phase, and I... this morning we heard about the many interesting seismic observations at the Cohn-Mentor boundary or near Cohn-Mentor boundary. This cartoon diagram shows or summarized the seismic important seismic observations at the Cohn-Mentor boundary, including this continuity that is observed 200 to 300 kilometers above the Cohn-Mentor boundary, and ultra-low velocity zones, core rigidity zones, and anisotropy. Okay, and this morning we also heard about the contrast between mantle and the core, expected interactions between these two layers. So I'm not going to go over this issue, but the key thing to bear in mind is that mantle is composed of solid silicate, and the core, actually outer core, is composed of liquid iron alloy. And the key issues in mirror physics, either to provide explanation about the seismic observations or provide input parameters or interpretations for the geodynamic simulations, some key issues are phase or composition changes at near Cohn-Mentor boundary, and that is probably relevant to the observation of discontinuity, and the shape and lattice or shape-preferred orientation of mineral phases at this high pressure and high temperature condition, and this may be relevant to the anisotropy observed at the Cohn-Mentor boundary, and the melting and chemical reaction between mantle material and core material is also a very important issue. The first thing I want to talk about is silicate melting. I know Dion will give us a review tomorrow, so I'm not going to go into detail about this interesting issue here. Well, as you may know, we have huge discrepancy between two different studies existing in the literature. The Berkeley group's melting curve for the iron-bearing magnesium silicate perovskite actually represents somehow lower end of existing melting curves. And then if you extrapolate this melting curve to the Cohn-Mentor boundary, which is probably somehow a very difficult thing to do because we don't have really good theory to extrapolate this melting curve to Cohn-Mentor boundary. And there are also other uncertainties such as details about mantle geotherm and temperature increase expected at the Cohn-Mentor boundary, but it is likely that this melting curve may cross the temperature at the Cohn-Mentor boundary. Or if you decide to believe this high melting curve, then you are really far away from the melting curve of magnesium silicate perovskite. And more recent result in shock wave, this is one data point provided by a shock wave experiment of olivine starting material, and they reported an evidence of the partial melt at the pressure conditions of the Cohn-Mentor boundary. And the paper by Zur et al., Mainz group, they did laser heated diamond cell experiment for a sample with pyritic chemical composition, and they actually find that they actually determine the solidus of pyritic sample and extrapolate to the Cohn-Mentor boundary conditions and claim that they observe consistent result with shock wave result. So well, some of these melting curves are consistent with the idea of having at least partial melt at the Cohn-Mentor boundary conditions, but the uncertainty still remains because we don't have good constraint for the melting curve of dominant lower mantle phase. And also, we don't know the exact chemical composition of melt or partial melt, and also residue of the melt. And we also don't know much about the amount of melt we could expect from this experimental result. There are a few interesting reports about reaction between iron and silicate or oxide at very high pressure conditions. For example, Berkeley group report a chemical reaction between magnesium silicate perovskite and iron, and this reaction actually produce iron silicide and iron oxide, which is supposed to have high electrical conductivity. The reaction level is not really small, actually it's pretty high, and this study has been confirmed by a study which was performed at 135 GPa, that is the pressure condition you expect at the Coulombic boundary. So it is likely that there is a chemical reaction between these two different phases. And then later on, Dubrovitsky has worked on several different systems. So he decided to look at individual oxide component and interaction with the iron. And in his report in 2001, he reported a chemical reaction between aluminum oxide and iron, and forming the iron and aluminum alloy. And interesting thing about this reaction is that he claimed that this reaction goes this direction, and the trend is getting stronger as you compress this material. In other words, you have more solubility as you compress this material at high pressure. And then he also studied the reaction between silicon dioxide or silica and iron, and he discovered the reaction between these two, but he claims that this reaction is suppressed by compression that virtually above 80 GPa, there is no reaction between these two phases, and the solubility of silicon in iron decreases substantially. And more interesting recent report by Dubrovitsky is that he reported a formation of alloy between iron and magnesium. And this is based on one conference abstract, so I cannot get the detailed information about this observation, but however, recently we have other interesting report about forming alloy between iron and potassium. And I know there are some groups who study the iron and calcium reaction at high pressure too. Well, to understand the anisotropy in terms of mineral physics at the Coulombic boundary, first information we have to know is the single crystal elasticity of mineral phases at the lower mantle. And unfortunately, experimentally, it's very difficult to measure the elasticity of lower mantle silicates in the laboratory. And one could also get the elasticity of silicate from first principle calculations, but most of them tend to be athermal calculations. So you mainly work with the pressure effect on this on the single crystal elasticity change as a function of pressure. So there exists a great deal of uncertainty here, but Kendall and Silva propose that shape preferred orientation is more likely mechanism than a lattice preferred orientation, and they actually examined the published single crystal elasticity of magnesium silicate perovskite, magnesium wustite, and stishovite, and they end up getting this conclusion. But in more recent study by McNamara and Carrado's group, they claim that the stress regime at the Coulombic boundary is in the regime of this this location. So you tend to have development of mineral texture in magnesioworstite, and this could result in the observed anisotropy in seismology for the coalmantle boundary. But still, these experiments are really performed at very limited pressure, and the argument about magnesium silicate perovskite is based on the experiment on analog material, not the magnesium silicate perovskite itself. So still we have great deal of uncertainty here to interpret the observed seismic anisotropy. Well, recent few years, experimentalists in mineral physics community have worked on developing high pressure techniques and synchrotron techniques, and now several groups in the community start to generate the pressure and temperature conditions of coalmantle boundary. This photo shows the diamond cell, and this is the sample inside the diamond cell. This is actually calcium silicate perovskite under pressure, which is about 50 GPa. That's mid-mantle conditions. And there are several techniques one can do measurement at in situ high pressure and high temperature conditions. So several groups, actually three groups, have performed independent high pressure and high temperature X-ray diffraction measurement of magnesium silicate perovskite at the coalmantle boundary conditions recently. And interestingly enough, they actually come up with very similar observations that magnesium silicate perovskite may transform to something else, some new phase near coalmantle boundary conditions. And it is really encouraging to see the consistent result from the experiment at this extreme conditions. And then theory come up with a very interesting result that they also consistent with these experiments, and they also able to come up with a very interesting structure which fits the observed X-ray diffraction pattern pretty well. And then the question immediately after finding this new phase is whether this phase can explain the observed seismic observations at the coalmantle boundary. And it's very difficult at this stage to measure the physical property of this material in the lab. Well, theory has been a major player to produce very interesting results, which may have significant implication for the interpretation of seismic observations at the coalmantle boundary. So I'm going to leave that part for the later talk this afternoon, which will be given by Renata. In the later part of my talk, I'm going to focus on the experimental observation of this post-perovskite phase. Well, all these three studies are based on X-ray diffraction, and this is the X-ray diffraction ring from the sample. Our samples are powder at this extreme conditions. Using powder X-ray diffraction to determine the crystal structure is really a difficult task to do. And in fact, this extreme high pressure and high temperature means that we inherently have some pressure gradient and some temperature gradient, which actually make things worse. So it is really difficult to determine the phase, the crystal structure, although we can pretty much do a good job by comparing our diffraction pattern with theoretical calculations or refinement. So this X-ray diffraction pattern was measured at 107 GPa after heating. We still observe the major diffraction peaks from magnesium silicate perovskite, which is indicated by PV here and PV here. And then when we heat the sample at 138 GPa, that's slightly higher than the coalmantle boundary pressure, but still within the uncertainty level, we start to observe new peaks rising at the lower angle, and also some at the high angle, although we cannot actually clearly show in this two-dimensional X-ray diffraction diagram. So the way we interpret this X-ray diffraction is to integrate into one-dimensional pattern and then compare with expected or X-ray diffraction intensity and peak positions of the known phases. For example, this is the observed X-ray diffraction patterns for different pressures and temperature conditions. And at the top, we plot the calculated X-ray diffraction patterns of magnesium silicate perovskite and magnesium oxide and silicon dioxide mixture. So up to 110 GPa, 17 GPa, we observed the X-ray diffraction pattern of magnesium silicate perovskite. And interestingly enough, when we hit this material at 139 GPa, 144 GPa, we start to see the new peaks coming in here, and a great deal of pretty big intensity change for these two peaks. And this peak shows several other lines at the shoulder. So this change cannot be explained by the orthorhombic perovskite. And then we take one of our X-ray diffraction pattern and plot here. And then we also calculate the X-ray diffraction expected for orthorhombic perovskite and proposed post perovskite phase and silicon and silica and MgO. And the reason we calculate four different X-ray diffraction pattern is to check whether there exists possibility of breakdown reaction of magnesium silicate perovskite into magnesium oxide and silicon dioxide. And this calculation is based on the first principle calculation result. So, and also for guidance, we actually put the arrow marks here. The orange arrow indicate the peak, which can be assigned to that of those of post-perovskite phase. And the light blue arrows indicate the peaks, which can be assigned to those of orthorhombic perovskite. And the observed X-ray diffraction pattern after heating to 2,500 Kelvin at 138 GPa shows both X-ray diffraction features of orthorhombic perovskite and the post-perovskite phase. And this diagram summarizes the pressure and temperature conditions where people performed in-situ X-ray diffraction measurement. The blue symbols, the light blue symbols, represents the pressure and temperature conditions where people have observed X-ray diffraction of orthorhombic perovskite. And the orange symbols represents the pressure and temperature conditions where people observed the post-perovskite phase. And the first diagram shows the data points obtained by other groups, and the second diagram shows the data points we obtained in our study. So all the way up to like 120 GPa, in other studies, they observed the synthesis of magnesium silicate perovskite or stability of magnesium silicate perovskite. And two different studies existing at this high pressure conditions, one by Murakami and the other by Oganov. And by the way, this study actually presents both a computational result and experimental result. And the data points here are the taken from their experimental part. So above 120 GPa, they observed the formation of post-perovskite phase. This trend is generally observed in our experiment too, but interesting contrast or difference between these two sets of data is that in our study, the post-perovskite phase was only observed when we heat the sample over 2,500 Kelvin. Well, there are many experimental uncertainties which may explain this little difference. But the interesting thing is that in our experiment, the perovskite is still persists after 10 minutes of heating at 2,500 K, and the heating duration below 2,500 was almost about 25 minutes. Instead, in previous observation, they reported that the diffraction pattern of post-perovskite phase appears only after 5 minutes of heating. So there is something to explain here. At this moment, I'm not sure which one is more reliable observations, but one thing I can point out in terms of experimental difference between these two studies is that in our study, we insulate the sample with chemically inert argon layers. Instead, in these two studies, they don't use thermal insulation material. And it is well known that the diamonds are very good heat conductors. So without insulation, in some case, you could have very steep axial thermal gradient. But I'm not sure that could be the answer for this case. Yeah. So this remains a, yeah.
I'm not very familiar with the second case, but I didn't get it.
Right.
Do you get the same similar structure?
Do you get the same? Yes. Well, first of all, you cannot actually determine the structure only with powder X-ray diffraction. Okay, what you can do is to compare your synthetic X-ray diffraction from structural model to your observed X-ray diffraction pattern. And what I've seen in our X-ray diffraction is that the proposed structure explains most of the dominant X-ray peaks we observed.
In both the same.
Yes. There are little differences, but I won't bother by that little difference. But the main point is that the X-ray diffraction peaks are pretty much consistent with theoretical result, the intensity and the peak positions.
But isn't it fair to say that your most intensity line is not the clear MCM structure, the one that's kind of like 2.6?
This one.
No, new one. That's at 9%.
Oh, new one. Oh, okay. This is different story. Okay. Well, that complicates a little bit story. Well, in our study in 2002, we examined the stability of magnesium silicate perovskite up to 105 GPa. And in that study, we observed a new peak appears after 88 GPa. That's about 1800 kilometer depth. That is this peak. And we interpret this peak as a possible indication of modification in perovskite structure. Okay. This is also an important issue because these other two studies here in this diagram, they also have data points near 88 GPA. Right? So the question is whether they observe this peak too. One of them did observe the same peak at these conditions, and the other didn't. So it's still, yeah, right. But still, our X-ray diffraction is well explained by the existence of orthorhombic perovskite. The matter is whether you have distortion in the structure or not. Nope.
Form of SiO2?
Nope.
A cold?
Nope. We also checked the stishovite too. So the calculation here is actually based on stishovite structure. Okay? All right. So you can compare the peak position of that with new one. So it's not stishovite. But anyway. Well, I put error bar here. Well, that's really difficult question to answer. Well, this error bar calculation is purely based on precision of the temperature and pressure. But there is another issue here, whether this pressure scale is really accurate or not. So it doesn't include accuracy. And if you include accuracy, the reasonable guess for the uncertainty of pressure is probably 10 GPa at this high pressure conditions. So pretty much like little less than 10% level.
What pressure scale?
I use Platin.
Platin?
Yes. There are just a couple of different pressures, platinum pressure scales. I use Holmes platinum pressure scale.
So the scattering of the data,
can you
give some indication on your own?
Scattering of the data?
Yeah.
No, this is actually, well, this is geotherm. Well, we try to cover many different pressure temperature conditions. It's not actually scatter. It's the pressure and temperature conditions we generate. Well, you want to be as close as possible to the geotherm. That's obvious, but it's not easy to control pressure and temperature that much well at these extreme conditions. So, well, to be honest, we didn't actually put effort to generate exactly the geotherm conditions. And geotherm itself is uncertain. So, but pretty much our data is around the geotherm. And these existing data are also around the geotherm, too. Yeah, it's not scatter, actually. Yeah.
So what you want to know is what the volume scatter is given those pressure ranges. Then you would say it will scatter, but this is just the PT.
Right. Yeah.
But to compare the top on the bottom plot, you have a variety of starting materials.
Yes, actually we have a variety of starting materials here. Okay, let's start with the previous studies. Murakami et al. Actually, they use glass starting material or gel starting material, and they first synthesize perovskite at lower pressure, and they increase the pressure for perovskite phase, and then they get this post-perovskite phase. So if you just concentrate on these data points, actually their starting material is magnesium silicate perovskite because they already synthesize at lower pressure. And that's still the same for our measurement because it's very difficult. Well, it's not difficult, but recovery rate of the experiment is pretty low, so we don't want to have risk to compress silica glass all the way up to 150 GPa and get nothing because diamond can sometimes break during this experiment. So the recovery rate of this experiment is pretty low. And the starting material of our experiment is also magnesium silicate perovskite.
Does it quench?
The quenchable?
Yeah.
The post-perovskite phase, I think it's consistent observation for all these studies. It's temperature quenchable. That means if you synthesize this material and drop the temperature or turn off the laser heating system, and you still see the diffraction pattern from post-perovskite phase, you are at high pressure. But once you decrease the pressure down to 80, 60, 70, and then perform the laser heating, you start to see the back transformation from post-spinel to post-perovskite to perovskite phase. Okay? I'm not sure. Well, for our experiment, our diamond, all of our diamond fails after the experiment. So we weren't able to check the quenchability of this material. And I think it's probably the same for the existing other studies too, because they don't show the X-ray diffraction pattern at zero pressure.
What's the level of shear stress in all these experiments?
That's a good question. Well, it's going to be huge. Well, how to quantify the level of shear stress in our sample is pretty difficult. There is indirect way to characterize the level of shear stress you have, but because of peak overlaps and other problems, it's very difficult to apply that method for this type of experiment. But One example I can give you is that we have performed the experiment for calcium silicate perovskite up to 90 GPa, and we estimate, I should say estimate, the shear stress, and was between 5 to 10 GPa level if the situation is really bad.
Sorry, what pressure?
90 GPa, 90.
So it's about
10%. Yeah, but that's the worst case. Well, if you do that, well, the shear stress is very sensitive to the way you anneal the sample and heat your sample. Okay? And this is too technical, so I'm not going to go into the detail. But if you, one way to relieve the shear stress is to heat this sample for a certain period of time, so that you recrystallize sample and stabilize the sample.
Well, my impression is that the shear stress affects significantly phase transformation. It's not like
that's
linear.
Right. Yeah.
You can observe phase transformation at
right.
30 GPa.
Right.
And you have shear stress 10 GPa.
Right.
It doesn't mean that phase transformation
right.
occurs something on the order of
1 right.
GPa.
Right.
It might occur much.
Right. Yeah, I do agree that the shear stress, existence of shear stress, has to be much concerned in this case. And yeah, well, that's one of the issues you have to deal with when you check the real stability or thermodynamic stability of this material at this extreme pressure and temperature conditions. Well, okay, I don't know much about these, all your studies, so I'm going to focus on my study. So we actually performed heating cycles here at 140 GPa, and first we decided to maintain temperature below 2,500 Kelvin. And at this time, we didn't know the existence of post-perovskite phase because we did this experiment about 2 or 3 years ago. Okay, and then we maintained the temperature below 2,500 Kelvin for 20 minutes, but we don't see any evidence of appearance of new peaks. And then we decided to increase the temperature a little bit. And then as soon as we increase the temperature from 2,500 to a little bit higher than 2,500, we almost instantaneously saw the appearance of new peaks. So it was not a matter of a few minutes, it was almost spontaneous response. Unfortunately, we didn't measure the X-ray diffraction when we decrease the temperature from this peak temperature. And that would be really nice to see the phase boundary. But the point here is that none of these data points can constrain the phase boundary at this moment. And we definitely need more data to constrain the phase boundary and phase slope. For example, I mean, we can claim the positive slope only with this loosely distributed data points. And the same thing holds for my data points, too.
When you say constrain the phase boundary,
Well, you can still say the phase boundary will exist between 110 and 130, but I mean, the uncertainty is too huge to compare with seismic observations, and you want to have tight constraint for the depth conditions. And also the same thing holds for your slope, because if this is real, and if you do exist, you do have a situation where you have both perovskite and post-perovskite phase in the co-mantle boundary conditions, and if the existence of both phases are sensitive to temperature, then you want to know the phase boundary slope, whether it's negative or positive, and the magnitude of it too. So I'm not going to go detail about the crystal structure because Renata will talk about more about these structures. The interesting contrast between magnesium silicate perovskite and post-perovskite phase is that in both phases, silicon is still coordinated by six oxygens. Difference is that magnesium in perovskite is coordinated by eight oxygens in closer distance and four oxygens in longer distance. So loosely say it's 8 to 12 coordinated magnesium in the structure. Interesting point is that in post-perovskite phase, magnesium is coordinated by only eight oxygens. So that's a little bit counterintuitive in some sense. But the other factor you have to consider when you talk about energetics of these phases is how to link oxygen, silicon oxygen octahedra. In magnesium silicate perovskite, silicon oxygen octahedra share one oxygen at the corner to form a three-dimensional network of the structure. And in post-perovskite phase, silicon oxygen octahedra shares edge instead of corner to form a two-dimensional layer type of structure. So that's pretty interesting contrast between these two structures. The interesting point about this post-perovskite phase transformation is that, well, experimentally, this is probably the first material, MgSiO3 is the first material which shows a phase transformation from perovskite to something else. And people start to study other perovskite structured materials, hoping that they will be able to see the phase transformation from perovskite to post-perovskite phase. But so far, there is no report about this type of study in the literature. So that's a little bit problem for the observed. So the magnesium silicate perovskite has to be really abnormal in that sense. But who knows, we can find other perovskite structured material which has similar type of phase transformation at high pressure. Recent theoretical studies actually have performed very thorough study about these materials and calculate the physical properties of this material and compare with seismic observations. And I'm not going to talk about these issues because Renata will cover this issue in her talk. I want to finish my talk by saying a few words about future studies required to confirm the existence of this post-perovskite phase at the co-mentor boundary, mainly experimental side. First, the existence of post-perovskite phase in more realistic chemical system has to be confirmed first. So far, the three studies, which is probably the all, they only performed experiment for magnesium end member. More study is needed to confirm the existence of this phase in iron-bearing systems, for example, or aluminum-bearing systems. And the PT slope of this post-perovskite phase transformation has to be determined. It's just pretty difficult task to do at this moment, but I wouldn't say it's impossible. There are other interesting physical properties to be measured for this material. If indeed this post-perovskite phase is the stable phase in the D double prime layer, we really have to measure the melting and element partitioning, elasticity, equation of state, and chemical reaction of the post-perovskite phase at in-situ high pressure and high temperature. And this is probably just few of the topics you can list. Thank you.